Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A that you can't find anywhere else. It's October 4th, 2023. I'm Eric Osterman, your host. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse is a DevOps accelerator for startups and teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by leveraging our 200 plus Terraform modules, battle tested and downloaded over 10 million times. No matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your company build a reliable, modern, and scalable infrastructure, transform your ClickOps into a well-oiled DevOps machine. By leveraging our open source and rock solid Terraform blueprints. And the result is you will launch better products, free up your bandwidth for innovation, and nail your value delivery every time. And if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with underperforming infrastructure, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll chart a roadmap for success for free. Worst case, you get a clear roadmap for shoring up your infrastructure. Best case, we co-build it with you and empower your DevOps team in 90 days or less. So how can you maximize today's session? First, our format is informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. This is a great place to ask. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Now, I have one ask. If you find any portion of our office hours valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse to find the video, or you can send us a short testimonial about the value you're getting in Slack just by going to slack.cloudposse.com and check out the office hours channel that we have there. Remember, we're not just simply creating content here. We are building a community. So with that said, let's get started with some announcements. First one is HashiCorp released 1.6 of Terraform. This has some exciting improvements in it. Most notably is additional work on the test framework. You can create these test HCL files and have run blocks, and it'll by running the Terraform test command, it will automatically provision and then destroy those environments. Plus, it will evaluate your custom assertions. This is obviously not a replacement for the full value of something that TerraTest does, but it handles like the 80% of simple test cases that you're going to need to implement with Terraform, and it builds it in natively. It's in HCL, so you don't have to learn Golang. You don't have to build a separate framework all around testing. So I think it's a nice improvement. The next one is enhanced. You know, in 1.5, they introduced config-driven imports. One of the nice things now, though, is in the import block, you can parameterize those variables. This makes the code a lot more reusable because of that. So I'm excited for that. And it makes it very GitOps friendly, of course. By moving to the import blocks, you have a definition of how to provision code through your CI/CD pipelines and import all at the same go, provided you're doing imports for some reason. Any other interesting observations on 1.6? Only other notable thing where they made some changes to the remote backend. So parameters that used to be at top level have now been nested under, I don't know the parent key, but they're now nested.
This should also be the one with the first change of license, I guess, for if
yeah, you yeah, exactly. So thank you for calling that out. So by upgrading to 1.6, you are now on a BSL licensed version of Terraform. Make sure you comply with the Terraform BSL license. But if you don't comply, you can now start testing out OpenTofu. OpenTofu released their first alpha of 1.6. Now, the versions aren't necessarily going to stay aligned forever, but they are staying aligned at this point. This release also incorporates some of the testing capabilities for feature parity with 1.6. I believe that you cannot even though those things are now, you know, added to the open source or to the BSL license Terraform 1.6, you can't just wholesale copy those in to OpenTofu without violating the license. So these types of things have to actually be re-implemented and in no large part borrow from whatever was in the HashiCorp Terraform version.
Besides being alpha, I guess the biggest drawback from this approach is the availability of the registry and all the modules, etc., that you need.
Well, so they are hosting a registry now that will properly resolve all the public providers and modules. So it really should be a drop-in replacement. But more than that, I don't know.
Yeah.
BSL. I know there was an announcement from Spacelift suggesting to not upgrade past 1.5.5.
Yeah.
Has anyone upgraded past that? Because I heard there was a technicality of patches would be released on 1.5 for some period of time underneath, I think, MPL. But obviously, Spacelift said 1.5.5 was like the hard stop. I wasn't sure if there was... if anyone's gone past that by chance.
I don't think they didn't actually necessarily say that. That was HashiCorp drew the line in the sand saying that version MB4 is still MPL licensed and everything after that will be BSL licensed. Because HashiCorp can't change the license of prior code that was in the public domain at that point.
Okay, just to clarify, so it was everything including the patch releases after 1.5.5, correct?
I believe that is correct. But I don't think HashiCorp is going to continue to release 1.5x releases. I think everything you'll see from this point forward will be 1.6x.
Sure. Yeah. Given that the release just dropped, definitely. Cool. Yeah.
So Spacelift and presumably many of the other taco providers, while they give you the option to select the version of Terraform you use, they usually have to support it in advance of you selecting that version because there are minor differences and the tacos tend to parse output from Terraform and their changes. You might be able to, upgrade behind the scenes with the version of Terraform you're running, but that would technically put you in violation of the BSL. And also it might not even work with Spacelift. I haven't seen, it looks like Spacelift is supporting OpenTofu already through the UI. Haven't looked at it yet.
I played around with it a little bit, and
you did?
I would say that the registry that is out there is not production ready yet. It still has some stability issues.
What were the kinds of things you were seeing?
I was actually getting at one point it was working, and then at another point not too long after that I was getting a bunch of 404 errors, and it went down. And then when I went to open a ticket for it, it basically said we're still working on this and it's flaky, don't use this in production. That was their warning on it.
Well, and even for this release here, they're saying the same.
Yeah.
Cool. Moving on then to the next announcement. It covers OpenTofu as well. So Lazarus, a popular, or popular is maybe a wrong word, a notorious hacking group, has a new form of phishing, or at least way of getting their malware out by luring employees at the company who may be looking for other opportunities to take a coding challenge, like as part of an opportunity to join Meta, for example. The engineers wrongfully run that on their work laptop for some reason, and voila, they have a backdoor into that network. Seems like, you know, it's always the weakest link is the human one. So it starts by fake recruiters contacting them via LinkedIn. I guess make sure you know who you're talking to. Make sure it's a legit recruiter. And don't run your coding challenges from your work laptop. All right. Another gist I came across. I guess it wasn't a gist. It was a post on a wiki here. But something that resonates with me a little bit. You know, oftentimes cases made that open source wins because it's the free alternative. But open source itself is A, not free to implement, adopt, maintain, keep it up to date, etc. And also for businesses thinking of competing using an open source model because it's the cheaper alternative, that is a race to the bottom, right? Competing on price and lowering your price, especially if you're a startup, is a very weak position to start by. So open source should really focus on just being the better alternative, just being a better product for the target market it's trying to solve for or help. So the article proposes a few different reasons a few different ways he or she believes they that open source wins. Any thoughts on that?
For me, the challenge with open source, a colleague of mine has said this a few times, is this is funny because the companies I've worked for, but when the person open sourced or the organization open sourcing it is their profit is tied directly to the production of that thing, it rarely ends up well. HashiCorp was an example of that, right? When they are a user of it, it's important for running their company, but it's not what they sell. That's when open source works better from contribution. So Linux is an example of that. Kubernetes is an example of that. The whole community contributes to it. It's not exactly related to what you said, but I'm seeing that more and more.
That's an interesting observation. Yeah. And provided it continues to be integral to their solution in some way so that they keep supporting it.
Gatekeeper
is an example where
they're like, okay. It's immediate contributions is my point then. Like, yeah. Companies see the threat. They don't want to do stuff because it interferes with their product when the community contributes to it, if they're making their enterprise version of the product. Or other vendors will take it, you know. Great example of that. Well, obviously HashiCorp more recently, I think their choice was not appropriate, and I think everybody else here agrees with that. But a better example would be Elastic, where Amazon did take it, made their own service from it, weren't contributing heavily to it. And so Elastic were like, crap, we gotta change our license. And then open source respond. But then you have tools. I think Grafana is a unique one in that they do make money on the tools they make, but the tools they make are also heavily contributed to by the community, like Prometheus, for example. But Kubernetes is a better, Linux and Kubernetes is a better example, or there's no one company. Obviously Google is a big player there, but there's no one company that's, you know, controlling it. It's ecosystem tools, right? That everybody contributes to, or the
world. Grafana is an interesting example. Outwardly they seem to be doing all right, but they're also not a public company, right? Or product of a public company, right?
I'm yeah, well, I think they've done well because they've found a good line between supporting the open source while having their enterprise stuff doesn't conflict with the open source.
Mm-hmm.
That's where HashiCorp went wrong with their enterprise. It conflicted with the open source. They did not want Terraform enhanced in certain ways because that would conflict with their product. That's kind of a tangent, but it's an interesting observation if you look at it. Now, I work for an open source company, and ours is a bit different because not many people are going to contribute to a massive scale database, big data thing. So it's not a common hobbyist thing to do at home. So ours is a unique case. But for the general infrastructure tools, it only works out in the end if you have if there truly is a community and not just one contributor. I guess the keyword there is open community, not just open source. Yeah. That's the anyway.
Yeah, I think Grafana is definitely not public, but they're giant. I think last year I remember seeing that they raised like $250 million or something like that on like a Series D or E or something. Raise. So they've got to have a multi-billion dollar market cap at this point because they've raised a ton of money.
Yeah, $500 million in funding.
Yeah. So yeah, Series D. Yeah. So they've raised four rounds. So
they're doing a good job of finding the balance between staying with the open, because there's no way they could decide to say, oh, we're changing the Prometheus license, or the community would never go for that. If they decide, oh, Prometheus is not, we're going to make our own thing now, you can keep the Apache version, they could the community would own Prometheus, right? They wouldn't, it's a community run project, but it's a big part of their and Grafana as well. Grafana is AGPL, but still there's a huge community effort to it.
Yeah, community part is quite important indeed. If you look at the original Ansible, it was open source, but basically it was really controlled so that basically what Terraform is right now, that you would hardly get anything in that was nice for you or for a lot of people, but not for the ones maintaining it. That's no change, luckily, but
most of their stuff is AGPL, except for Prometheus is not. I don't know if they were the originator. I don't think they were the originators of Prometheus. They just became one of the main contributors. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, I didn't just, I in my own memory, I didn't remember them relicensing to AGPL.
Loki is also AGPL.
Mm-hmm.
And Tempo.
All right. Next mini announcement was shared in the office hours Slack. It's just a heads up. So if you are relying on Node 16 being end of life in April of 2024, well, that was accelerated due to some issues, I guess, with OpenSSL or vulnerabilities tied to that. So rather than try and backport those fixes and invest more in it, they're just sunsetting it earlier.
Yeah, the main reason I brought this up also is that if you do switch to Node 18, you also need to make sure that your code base is AWS SDK 3 compatible, because Node 18 by default supports AWS SDK 3. Whereas Node 16 still uses AWS SDK 2 by default.
Okay, so it could be a bigger lift.
Yeah.
All right. Minor announcement from AWS. Didn't see too many other exciting announcements, general announcements, but they have added better filtering and search on the public AWS registry. Also seems pretty snappy, which is nice. We have started, publishing most of our images to the AWS registry, so they aren't rate limited and works well within the whole IAM paradigm of AWS. So search is welcome there. If you've been using AppRunner and you are using a monorepo, now you can use both. So AppRunner adds, I guess, patterns for working with monorepos. AppRunner is basically Amazon's response to Heroku. If you want a really simple way to get your environments up on AWS without all the infrastructure and scaffolding and things that you need, that's what AppRunner is.
Yeah, before it only supported the root directory basically as the spot where you could do like build and your start commands. Now basically, I mean, this whole announcement basically is you can specify like a CWD path to run before running build and start. I mean, that's the TLDR of what happens here. So it's not, it sounds a lot more sophisticated than it really is.
Yeah. So I guess it's not that it supports any optimized strategy for monorepos, deploying a collection of services out from a monorepo. It's just supporting nested.
Yeah, the path, basically paths. Yeah.
Okay. That's good clarification. Couple minor announcements for GitHub Actions. So one exciting one is that Apple Silicon is now in the public beta. Unfortunately, it's not available for open source as far as I can tell. So you are going to pay for those runs, but it will simplify building ARM packages on GitHub and GitHub Actions using public runners.
I think the main thing that people were excited about this is now you can build iOS apps, using GitHub, GitHub runners now, because or Mac app, Mac desktop apps, which before most people would have their pipeline for everything else, and then a different pipeline that would build and publish their iOS and Mac apps and that kind of stuff.
Isn't using Kemu or something is a common way? I mean, incredibly inefficient, but
there's you can only build iOS apps on Mac. So there's actually there's specific like CI systems made, just to do that whole pipeline and doing app signing and publishing to the App Store and everything else. And I think some people are excited not to have to pay for third-party services or additional third-party services. Now they can start using Apple's, like the GitHub runners to actually do that themselves. So it'll be interesting to see if more people move that way.
They've also raised the concurrency limits for hosted runners, which is nice. We use these extensively for like package builds. So previously the limit was a concurrency of 250 concurrent builds. Now you can do 1,000 concurrent builds. And it's pretty freaking awesome to see it. Like for open source projects, you'll literally see, if you're developing your pipelines and such, 1,000 workers then spawning off and running your workload, and you're not paying anything for it. So thank you, GitHub, for that. That's pretty amazing. Now for everyone else paying for it, thank you for subsidizing our builds.
Actually, Eric, I know you just said that, but isn't that only available on the 4 CPU, the quad CPU runners?
Wait, previously can made backend improvements for runners with. Oh, so this is. Wait, no, I guess don't they mean GitHub hosted? So this is GitHub Cloud, right? So
right, but if you can't use those larger scaled instance sizes without paying for them.
Oh, okay, yeah. Got it. never mind. I take that all back.
I was like, wait, it's still not free, right? You confused
me. Yeah. So they made the ATM machine print money faster for people paying.
Yeah.
And force canceling of workflows. And you can do that actually through the API too. All right. Any other announcements? Anything else caught people's attention? There were some other tools mentioned in the office hour Slack. I didn't announce them just because we brought them up previously.
This might be a little in the weeds, but I heard that GitHub, when they got acquired by Microsoft, they were like doing some type of move over to Azure. With macOS, does that mean it's going to be like a hybrid cloud, or does anyone here know if Azure supports macOS now? Because I'm under the assumption that they're still using AWS to roll out this new feature. But curious to know if anyone
that's interesting on that.
I did a little like exploration and ran a whole bunch of different jobs recently and tried to identify the source IP addresses of where things were coming from just to see what clouds they were running on. And I was actually still getting almost like a 50-50 split between AWS and Azure. So I don't know that that's actually even been like nearly completed. And they might actually have a long-term multi-cloud strategy just in case.
Cool. Yeah. I'm thankfully sure the results of that test. Thank you.
I recall Azure DevOps supporting macOS agents, but.
Well, that might, yes, self-hosted probably the case, but managed runners on Apple Silicon. I didn't see.
That would mean that Azure would have to have Apple Silicon like actual VMs available to run on. So, which I don't think. Yeah, I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
I did a couple quick Google searches and didn't see anything, but I'm not up to date on the most recent Azure portal and where they put everything.
Cool.
Thanks for that insight, Matt. Really appreciate it.
So Isaac asks a question. Has anybody heard of rig.dev? No, it looks interesting. Well, just by that. What is, where did you come across it, Isaac?
I have an Android, so Google knows everything I search, and every now and then they suggest articles to me.
So apparently Azure App Center and Azure DevOps Pipeline both can generate Apple-compatible binaries, but I don't know that they specifically have hosted Mac OS, Mac VMs that you could specifically target for.
I just put in the chat with Azure Pipelines, say Azure DevOps. It says they do.
Okay.
That might be still on the x86 platform, though, not on the new silicon.
Yeah, the only thing I do remember from the Mac EULA is that if you want to virtualize, if you want to run virtual Mac, it has to run according to the EULA on Mac hardware. So that's the only part I'm very certain of in this space.
Yeah, unless of course you're one of the three major cloud platform providers that has an agreement with Apple to not do that, which I'm sure that's what, under the hood, that's what Amazon is doing for, you know, I doubt that they have, you know, only racks of Mac Pros or whatever running that, but maybe they do. I could be wrong.
I heard that they do. I heard they actually retrofitted like Mac Minis into the data center.
Well, that's what I linked above. If you look at that, the comment in the chat, that link shows that that's what they do. They have agents that run macOS images provision on Mac Pros.
Oh, cool.
Doesn't say if they're the newer ones or if they're still running older Intel-based ones. But,
which, yeah. This one here.
The hardware one, yeah. This is for Azure Pipelines. It's the next, mm-hmm. it's the next paragraph.
That seems it's interesting because if you read all their strategies on rack density and optimizing physical space with power and cooling and everything, that seems like it'd be really hard to do with desktop profiled machines. You wonder if they like pull all the guts out and re-rack them or do something, you know, do something crazy to make it fit in the rest of their into the rest of their model that they run.
Or like all things Mac, just charge a lot more money.
Yeah, possibly.
I do recall many years ago that Mac had like server grade hardware that at that time.
They discontinued that like not too long ago.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions we can get to today? Also, we have this nifty new Q&A feature in Zoom, so feel free to post questions in there as well. Hey, Blaze.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I was just wondering, do folks have a sense of whether, like, the GitHub runners are they actually cheaper than doing stuff on AWS, or is it just the convenience of having it all, like, in GitHub? And, like, what's their angle?
Do you mean like
paying for those runners? Yeah, like, you know, when you if you actually have to pay, which
gotcha,
to use the bigger runners.
Yeah, so does it make more sense to self-host your own runners in AWS or pay for the GitHub hosted runners, and has anyone kind of compared apples to apples the cost of those, if there is any?
Yeah, I think, I don't know about the cost, but the direct cost may be comparable or slightly more on the GitHub side. But don't forget that managing those things, making sure they scale properly, setting it up and configuring it, doing all that doesn't come for free either. You know, monitoring it, troubleshooting when it goes wrong, you know, .. It doesn't come for free. And there are also a fair number of companies out there that don't host their own like cloud infrastructure. They only like they're building giant applications that they're shipping to Vercel or you know other people like that as well. It makes a lot of sense for them to have a place to do all these builds and that kind of thing. Or they're shipping to some other kind of managed platform where they're not running the underlying platform.
Right. So they don't have a whole lot of spare compute lying around.
Yeah.
Like I do.
But also, if you think about it, now you have to get your pipeline to provision your AWS environment with whatever provisioning you want to use, just so that you don't have the perpetual cost of having compute running around, because as long as that compute exists, you're paying for it. So if you really want to optimize the cost aspect of it, you're going to need to like provision on the do a lot more dynamic provisioning, which means you're going to need something in advance of actually doing your build. So
yeah, that was what my point was, that like setting that all up and making sure it scales properly and does all that kind of thing and keeping track of it does not come for free.
Yeah, fair enough.
There's a couple services out there that will help you manage your self-hosted pools in GitHub. They've basically built a middle layer of, rather than doing it yourself, they'll kind of do it for you, and it's supposed to still save you money. I forgot the name, but...
remember.
Actuated?
What was that? Actuated?
Yeah. Actuated.dev, I think. That's one of Alex Ellis's projects.
Oh, cool. I didn't realize he had that project. There was another one that does free for open source. The team I'm working with, we have a lot of open source repos right now, but this looks like another good solution as well.
I heard of another one. This one didn't sound familiar.
The other one that I heard of, I think might be the same one you heard of, Eric, but they run the compute on your behalf, like in their cloud, right?
Yeah, in their cloud. Oh, is this in your cloud?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's in your cloud.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what's the one? What's the other one, Matt?
I can't remember the name of it, okay. But I remember seeing the same thing, and I kicked the tires and looked at it for a while. So, yeah, I just don't remember the name. I'm the worst, and I didn't take notes on it because I didn't look too deeply at it.
All right, then. We got some more questions here. Alex Atkinson asks, has anybody heard of flow.swiss? Looks like I gotta reload my page here. Swiss premium cloud committed to scalable online cloud community platform equipment. Is this yet another public cloud offering? Yeah, I'd never heard of it. Console in the industry.
So they're basically just saying it's a visibility layer on top of other clouds. Oh, I guess not. Maybe it does other things.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering, because it's not super clear what exactly they're offering.
I think it's like banking, Swiss banking, right? It's based in Switzerland.
Oh.
Right, I mean, and Switzerland is not part of the Switzerland is not part of the EU, so they're not subject to whatever, you know, law enforcement agencies might get your data from the EU.
Fair enough.
I mean, to me, calling it Swiss would evoke some kind of secrecy.
Yeah, they're big on privacy.
Well, it can't be Swiss and multi-region.
That is a good point.
Multi-canon,
you're broken.
Yeah, they have one in Bern and Basel.
There's actually a very, very large data center presence in, I think, Winterthur, which is like near Germany, I think, in Switzerland, too.
So we took that one. Isaac asks in the Q&A, if you have a multi-account setup with multiple peered VPCs, at one point you should begin thinking of an alternative architecture like Transit Gateway to simplify monitoring or control.
I meant at what point, sorry.
Okay, yeah, at what point? Yeah, gotcha. Matt, you want to take this one?
Yeah, I think my general rule of thumb on this would be is when you get to some level of complexity that's more than just a couple of accounts or a couple of VPCs peering to one another, it almost always makes more sense from a management and scalability perspective to then go to Transit Gateway, especially if you find yourself creating like a mesh peering among like two or three or four accounts, it becomes much simpler and easier to understand and manage when you get to that level. But I don't think there's any hard and fast answer as to like
anecdotally, I can say almost every single time we provision our reference architecture, we also provision a transit gateway. The reason why we always do it is because, you know, going back to like GitHub runners, when if you want to manage resources inside of a private VPC from a centralized place like an automation account where your runners are deployed, how do they do that? And you could set up peering, but that would be a lot of work to manage with a lot of accounts. and therefore we just set up the transit gateway, and it's so easy. I think Matt's point about the mesh, as soon as you see yourself doing mesh-like networking, that also then makes sense. But be advised of the cost. So we have some other customers that, although we still deploy transit gateway, they also deploy VPC peering, where it will help them reduce their costs.
Thanks. The only catch in those scenarios, I would suggest, and I've seen where this goes wrong as well, is having some form of IPDB. So you can keep track of subnets, use subnets allocated. So you don't have overlapping subnets in your peering and in your VPC configurations. I've seen where people go and create a new account and then set up, copied a deployment script with with existing IPs and like couldn't peer to anything because nothing would accept the overlapping IPs.
That's helpful for sure. When I set this up, I did use IPAM, and it's an organizational module that everyone uses to create their VPCs. So it's always going to get a block that is not overlapping. But it's just at the point, you know, the costs of gateway drove me away from it. But after seeing just how quickly someone wants to peer to this one and peer to the other one, I'm like, maybe that was not the right decision. But maybe it was at the time. And now we've just outgrown it.
Well, the fact that you're doing IPAM is a good sign that money is not a concern. So,
the other thing with transit is I think you also can do your service endpoints through transit. So you can do transit gateway to S3 and Dynamo and some other services through transit that you wouldn't need, that you wouldn't be able to achieve through peering solutions. So that would mean that your egress cost for sending data to S3, as an example, would be much lower if that's a service that you often use, just as an example, through transit endpoint or through a service endpoint, which basically leverages, to the best of my knowledge, the transit gateways.
Now, VPC endpoints, like private VPC endpoints, are just provisioned in your VPC. You can do that whether you have transit gateway or not.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, those are not dependent on transit gateway. The one thing we have seen a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot, but we've seen some larger customers use is a, like if you have some sort of, fancier edge firewalls or third-party WAF solutions or logging and monitoring solutions for all your ingress and egress traffic to the internet. We've actually seen a lot of people use Transit Gateway to have an internet account, specifically where you do all of your external traffic traversal inbound and outbound through that single account. And then you have a single location where you can two different regions potentially in a single account for redundancy. But then you have a single point where you can run third-party appliances and those types of things that you might be running on your traffic as well. That's another good reason to use Transit Gateway.
Awesome. That makes sense.
A couple of years ago, we actually was working with a customer where we engineered a similar solution to the one that you just described, except they wanted everything to go out through their on-prem, the on-prem, let's call it, for sake of a better word, proxy. And they only had one direct connect to one specific VPC. So exactly that reason is we just brought all the traffic back to one VPC and default gateway the traffic back across the direct connect for internet egress.
Yep. And you can, using Transit Gateway, you can actually connect AWS VPN, and then you can run like a full BGP like mesh throughout all of your on-prem and cloud resources between them. So you can get into some very complex networking scenarios with using it.
So I saw your message, Jonathan. Eunice, you're still struggling, or you're still having DNS issues in Kubernetes?
No, I fixed them. But in kind of doing this deep, crazy deep dive through core DNS and how everything is configured, I've found a configuration that I think could only be described as criminal. We were basically blasting through something like 60 million DNS queries a day. I mean, just incredible numbers. Our cluster isn't that big. We had something like a 60% failure rate on all DNS queries, or failure. The queries were answered, but they were answered with, we can't find that domain. I have never in my career, I think, achieved what I did this week, which is we've got a 4, maybe 5 decimal order of magnitude improvement in our error rates. We were, 60% error to now we're measuring it in thousandths of a percent of errors. And it all comes down to this. Kubernetes insists on in.5 as its DNS search parameter. And so it's every time you query for something like S3 on Amazon AWS.com, it's making all sorts of crazy assumptions like, well, maybe that's cluster local. Maybe it's service cluster local. Maybe it's namespace cluster local. And it does all of those searches before it just says, hey, maybe this is an absolute DNS address. So we've just completely slashed our DNS query load and error rate. But I mean, the fact that it took so much effort to do it, it's taken, multiple individual days of my time. But the fact that it's possible to make a 4 decimal order of magnitude improvement in error rates off the base configuration, that's a crime.
What were the errors?
What number of n-dots did you change it to then?
N-dots 1. Assume that given a DNS query, that they're really serious about answering that DNS query. And then you can search after that and give it search domains after it. But apparently, I mean, this is in the Kubernetes DNS debugging docs in .5, search all these cluster local domains before you just answer the question asked. And I think that probably makes sense if your cluster is, it's like one of those beginner demos where your app server is called app and your database is called DB and your Redis server is called Redis, and you try to access things without any kind of absolute names. But we were blasting through literally millions of AWS queries of AWS service names. And it was asking things like, well, is this cluster local? Is this service cluster local? Is this in the EC2 internal domain? I mean, just ridiculous error, just ridiculous.
I mean, they're errors, but they're intentional. It's like, I mean, that's just how you, it's like cash hits versus cash misses, right? Ideally, everything's a cash hit, but sometimes,
I know, but with N.5, we had a 60% failure rate of the cache. With N.1, we have what is it right now? It's 4.7 times 10 to the negative 3. It's in the thousands.
For services to resolve other services within the same namespace conveniently without using a canonical host name. Of the service, which you can use, but some of the beauty of Kubernetes is like it's cartridge plug and play. You have your services running in the same namespace; they all find each other, and they don't need to know the namespace to resolve the other services. So that's why that's there. But you don't need NDOTS 5 for that. You know, NDOTS probably 2 or 3 would be adequate.
Right. But you can't set that on a cluster basis, as far as I know. Like, it was really hard.
Yeah, I only remember setting it in ResolveConf. But
it was pretty hard to apply this across all of the different services, you know, external DNS, and I mean, core DNS itself,